I sort of assumed when I started this program, even not being aware of the fire movement, that I would just pay him off as quick as I humanly could. Once I realized the amount of debt I was going to walk out with, I realized that maybe that wasn't even going to be possible.
Hello and welcome to the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I'm your host, Travis Hornsby, and I'm excited to be here today with Caitlin Bailey, a student at one of the major alternative medicine, naturopathic institutions, universities in the West Coast. So, Caitlin, thanks so much for being on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Travis.
So, I've got a question for you. What is a naturopath?
Yeah, it's a little bit less common than your primary medical doctor. We're a subset of alternative medicine, and depending on the state, we're considered primary care doctors. And so, we're able to prescribe medications, run your blood work through the lab, even do minor surgery. And then in some states where our licensure isn't as broad, we're considered more lifestyle doctors. And so we spend a lot of time talking with people about nutrition, sleep, botanical medicine. And so we're just able to tap into people's health when surgery and medications haven't quite reached what's going on for them.
How is a naturopathic doctor related to a chiropractor?
We actually share similar history. A lot of chiropractic colleges used to have naturopathic programs or vice versa. And so our roots overlap quite a bit. A lot of the prominent naturopaths in history were also chiropractors. I know chiropractors still consider themselves the drugless profession in that they don't write prescriptions. And so we differ in that way in that in a lot of states, we have prescribing rights and we can prescribe quite a few medications, you know, much like your conventional doctor. We do get trained in the manipulation like chiropractors, but I would say it's not our main modality.
Okay. What kind of medications are you guys allowed to prescribe?
It varies on the state, but it does include, you know, antibiotics, some pain medications. It's really the comfort of the doctor and what their specialty is. And so you'll see some doctors who don't have a lot of interaction with mental health patients. And so maybe they aren't prescribing the big heavy hitters like benzodiazepines or opioids, but we do write a lot of prescriptions for your cholesterol medications, acid blockers, your kind of everyday medications a lot of people are on.
Sure. So some people, right, view naturopathic medicine, acupuncture as controversial fields, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously, I'm sure that could be a whole podcast episode talking about all those things. What would you say in terms of the value that a naturopathic doctor can provide to patients just in general? I'll just stop there.
Yeah. So I think a lot of the pushback on naturopaths is that there are some schools that offer online programs and you can get a degree and call yourself a naturopathic doctor without ever seeing a patient, without ever setting foot in a classroom. And so that's where a lot of sort of misconception occurs. But I think the benefit is that our training, we spend a lot more time talking about, like I said, the lifestyle medicine and how to manage nutrition, how to manage sleep, stress, exercise in a way that maybe a conventional doctor just doesn't have the time to do, especially in a larger hospital system. You know, they're really oriented to seeing patients quickly in an efficient manner. And it's not unusual for us to have the time to sit down for an hour, sometimes 2 hours, and really take a deep dive as to why someone's maybe blood sugar isn't getting under control or why their medications aren't helping lower their blood pressure or their diabetic status. So we have the benefit of more training in those areas and also more time to sit down with patients and really figure out what's going on for them.
So do you get insurance reimbursement or how does the actual payment process work for services?
Yeah, it again varies on the state because our licensure, we're not federally licensed. It's a state-by-state basis. So where I live in Oregon, the state sees us as equal to primary care doctors. So in that sense, we do get reimbursed by insurance companies. In other states where we're unlicensed, we don't have the full scope of sort of services that we can offer people. And so that tends to be that's a cash pay type fee-for-service oriented clinic where you're sitting down and just having someone pay per hour or per procedure that they come in for.
For sure. So what's interesting here is what would you say the average income is of a naturopathic doctor in Oregon?
It's definitely going to be lower than your conventional doctors. You know, you might look at conventional doctors who go into primary care and sort of $100,000, $150,000 is being sort of an average family doctor, family medicine income. We're probably in that realm, but maybe towards the lower end because of, like I said, the difficulties with insurance companies. We sometimes don't always get reimbursed at the same rate as conventional doctors. So I'd say conservatively right around the $100,000 mark. And then depending on where you're outside clinic interests lie as far as maybe getting involved with supplement manufacturing or writing, sometimes closer to 150 or 200,000.
So I have to be a little bit of a devil's advocate here. So the naturopaths that I've worked with Student Loan Planner, their income has been a lot lower than advertised after graduation, right? So I don't know if this is because of the expectations are kind of higher, or if people kind of think that they're going to be in the top quarter of the income distribution. And then, you know, obviously the law of averages, you know, comes into play, or if this is because maybe I'm talking to a lot of these folks that are not in some of these states that accept as much insurance.
Yeah.
What do you think the chances are that the schools that are trying to recruit people to pay, you know, tons of money for the education are overstating the results of graduates in terms of income and job placements?
Yeah, I think it's difficult because I think it's a profession where you get out of it what you put into it. And, you know, conventional doctors have sort of a whole path after graduation where they do residencies, fellowships, research. And so they have a very clear picture of where they're going after graduation, and oftentimes a very sort of certain income stream of, you know, maybe I don't get a really high paying residency, but at least I know I'm going to make some money. And residencies on the naturopathic side, they aren't required. They are recommended and they're highly competitive and prestigious, but not everyone gets them. And so what that leaves is a lot of people after graduation kind of in a point where they have to really turn on an entrepreneurial gene that maybe they don't have and build their own practice. Because a lot of doctors, you know, we're not highly integrated into big hospital systems, obviously not involved with like the VA or Medicare. So we have to really orient ourselves towards private practice and creating our own income streams. And I think the school could spend more time getting people prepared for that as far as a business owner and how to prepare yourself right out of graduation to make money. So I do think it's difficult because you have to have a vision of where you see yourself going after graduation and make sure it's profitable. And I think a lot of times the school focuses on making us great doctors, but we don't always have the training to make ourselves great small business owners and great private practice operators.
And honestly, that's the whole key indicator of whether or not you're going to be successful, right? Can you operate a small private practice?
Exactly. And so I think that's where a lot of people struggle. They tend to join other people's practices as independent contractors, taking either a, you know, amount of money per patient that they see or a sort of flat rate regardless. And so that tends to maybe limit your income potential because you're under contract of someone else's practice that they've created. And that's, I think, fairly common, especially the first couple years out, is joining an existing practice and just kind of taking a smaller amount of income than you could potentially make if you were really able to set up a business for yourself.
Can you tell me what the typical new grad, what kind of job they're getting? Like, are they working for somebody else straight out of school as an associate? Are there big corporations in the naturopathic world that employ new grads? What do the job options look like?
I would say the vast majority end up joining existing practices. And that's sort of, like I said, taking on an independent contractor role within someone's practice. And sometimes they're other naturopaths, sometimes they're chiropractors or MDs who want to sort of create an integrative setting for their patients. And so you tend to walk into those positions most readily after graduation. There are some smaller opportunities to get into research. You can stay in academia. We have a lot of residents who eventually become faculty at our school. And there's a sort of smaller group of people who may go into either like corporate wellness or also supplement advising. So working with the various supplement companies as far as formulation or research or product testing. But I would say that that's less frequently than the people who are seeking out to join an existing practice.
Do you think that most of the people that were in the program with you, do you think that they just had this incredible passion for being a naturopathic doctor? Or do you think that they wanted to go into a different health professions path and they just decided that they would do this one? Or do you think that, like, what is like the, you know, the kind of average student in your program? Like, is this something that they kind of fell into, or is this something they've been dreaming of doing?
Yeah, it is funny because I do get kind of the stigma of like, oh, you guys are just doctors who couldn't get into medical school, conventional medical school. And so this is just the path of least resistance. And I'd say for the vast majority of people, that's not the case. They're here because they want to be. And a lot of times it's because they've had their own health issues. They've had a chronic issue that medications didn't touch or that they never resolved completely with Western medicine. And that caused them to seek out this type of medicine for themselves. And they saw for themselves the benefit for their own healing and decided that they had enough passion to get the degree themselves. So the vast majority of students, I think, are here because they really believe that our healthcare system is broken and that it isn't getting people well, that it's treating symptoms and not causes. And so that's a big motivator for people to come in and get into a subset of medicine that I think is really looking at the root cause and how to get people well.
Sure. I mean, one thing that I can definitely agree on is our healthcare system is very messed up. Mm-hmm. But anyhow, one question that I have is you're dependent upon becoming, an independent contractor, right? To make mm-hmm. your starting salary maybe of like $60,000 coming out of school. If you're a successful small business owner, you might make low six figures. And more likely than not, you're going to maybe start your own practice and have a lot of expenses like rent and overhead, utilities to pay, right? And for a business like, frankly, like mine, like we don't necessarily have the expense of having a storefront, of having a receptionist, right? Or, just these various things that naturopaths would have to pay for. Mm-hmm. So I guess like what I'm saying here is the income potential is definitely limited unless you're a stellar small business person, mm-hmm. right? And so you come out owing all this student loan debt, and then you're kind of a little bit thrown to the wolves in the sense of you got to go figure out your independent contractor status. You've got to probably get a CPA to help you out, figure out your taxes when you're making $60,000 to $70,000 instead of maybe a dentist who might be making $120,000, $130,000. So there's less money there to pay that flat fee for the professional to get help, right?
Yeah.
I guess the question I'm asking is, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the length of programs that are out there for naturopaths. And I know that you're also getting we talked a little bit before, you're getting a master's degree of acupuncture as well. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the length of the programs that are out there for becoming a naturopath or an acupuncturist. And what are the costs?
Yeah, I think I mentioned briefly that it is possible to go online and sort of get these degrees from maybe fly-by-night alternative health website-oriented schools. Oftentimes, they aren't recognized at a state level to get an actual license to practice. But in the U.S., I believe we have 6 or 7 accredited naturopathic colleges. It's a 4-year program, similar layout to conventional medicine in that your first year or two is heavy in the lecture components. And then in your later years, you start rotating through different types of shifts and different doctors and seeing patients and eventually end of graduation, trying to go for a residency. So it's a 4-year program. The acupuncture that I've added on its own is also a 4-year program. And so when I melded them together, I ended up with a 6-year program. And the reason I did that was acupuncture was the first sort of modality that I had for myself. And I saw some really sort of dramatic improvements in just 3 visits. And I sort of couldn't believe that I only spent $50. I was here for 30 minutes each time, and I have completely eliminated the pain that I was having and sort of caused me to explore it. So I sort of, in the sense that I couldn't choose which subset of medicine I love more, I went for both of them. And in retrospect, I don't know if I would have chosen differently if I had understood fully the implications of the loans after 6 years. But what I do know is that as an acupuncturist, sort of reimbursements at a higher rate with the naturopathic medicine added in because I'm able to bill as a doctor performing acupuncture as opposed to a acupuncturist performing acupuncture. And so a lot of schools, the 4-year acupuncture or naturopathic programs are complemented by other sort of 1 or 2-year programs like nutrition or research. And that's to sort of maybe orient someone in a particular direction. Like I was saying, maybe going into supplement research or consulting for the supplement companies, you could pick up a master's degree to sort of further specialize your education. So it's not unusual for the naturopathic colleges to also have some smaller 1 to 2 year master programs floating around.
Cool, Caitlin. So what would you say is the cost yearly in tuition, fees, living expenses for attending a naturopathic school?
I would say about $30,000 a year, including your fees. I wouldn't say that would include all your books and medical equipment. So maybe $30,000 to $35,000.
Okay, $30,000 to $35,000. That you said that does not include everything?
The school has us purchase our medical equipment outside of our tuition. So as a good doctor, you need a stethoscope and the otoscope to look in someone's ears. And so a lot of that equipment we're buying outside of school's tuitions.
Okay. So what would be like an all-in cost if you included living expenses?
With living expenses, I'd say you're probably $45,000 to $50,000, depending on your lifestyle and you know, what sort of support you have from your family or spouse.
So that's where it gets difficult for me, because I've seen an average balance. I was looking through some data just to see what the average naturopath had that we had worked with. And it looks like it's around 250 to 350 with an average kind of on the higher end of that. So I think that happens with the 50K debt times four, that's 200, right? And then tack on accrued interest, tack on loan fees, tack on just the various other things that come up. And then you're kind of up at 250 to 300 kind of almost immediately. And then you know, you have a few years after graduation where you're trying to figure things out. You don't have a plan. You're just kind of doing whatever. And then the interest continues to grow, right?
Yeah.
I wonder what you would say to this. Like, I do wonder about the ethics of the schools themselves charging $200,000 to $300,000 for a degree whose incomes are $60,000 to $80,000 a year. You know, what do you think about that?
I think it's really difficult. I think speaking with doctors who graduated maybe even 10, 15 years ago, the upper division graduate level costs of education have risen dramatically. And I think what I think you've published on your website before too is that a lot of lenders make the interest rates higher for graduate school programs, but also the schools know that they can really increase the maximum loans that people can withdraw to support these programs. And so I think there's been a massive inflation in the cost in the last 10 to 20 years that has really put it at a sort of untenable position right now, where I do agree mathematically it doesn't make a lot of sense. And it's a real difficult dilemma to put yourself in when you're financially savvy and aware of these things, but also highly passionate about the medicine and the ability to treat people in this way. So it's kind of putting yourself in a hard position like myself, where I'm halfway through the program. I've seen the amount of debt that I've accumulated so far, but I still really believe that this specialized subset of medicine is really beneficial for a lot of people and beneficial for myself in an ethical, value aligning way that I want to live my life.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about your personal financial setup and talking a little bit about what you might be able to do to handle this debt burden when you graduate. So, you know, you currently have a spouse, right? And they can like $50,000-$60,000 a year?
Correct.
Okay. And I think you don't have a car payment, which is good, right? 2007, a Honda Accord. That's pretty good. Paid off.
Yeah. Downgraded before I started school. So at least was financially savvy enough to realize I wasn't going to make car payments with my student loan money.
How do you and your spouse view finances? Jointly, separately? Talk a little bit about that.
Definitely jointly. We actually got engaged my first year of the program and had some honest conversations about, you know, I didn't want to put that debt on someone else. And she's very supportive of this type of medicine because she's also seen it benefit herself and her sort of chronic health picture. And so she's highly, highly supportive of the fact that I'm doing this out of passion and not because the dollar and cents really add up at the end of the day. You know, like I said, she has a little bit of income and supports us in paying most of our sort of fixed living expenses, mortgage, gas, stuff like that. And I cover a lot of my school related expenses and just sort of eating out and occasional medical supply, textbook type stuff with my own money.
Sure. So I want to dig into that a little bit more. So Oregon is bizarrely one of the only West Coast states that is not a community property state.
Mm-hmm.
So that has a little bit different rules in place for paying back your student loans on an income-driven repayment program. For your situation, you know, a couple of the conversations that I would have with somebody who is not already married is, how important is it to be legally married versus spiritually married? And that's like a personal decision. So a lot of people don't know that you can have the ceremony, you can get married in front of friends and family and promise each other that you're going to love each other forever, but then not turn in that legal certificate, which makes you legally married. And then now you have to file, you know, married filing jointly or married filing separately tax returns, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting. It's really unique to each person what they say to that. So like, I've had people that have said, okay, well then we're just not going to turn in that paper. So then that we don't have to worry, we can do the pay as you earn plan or the revised pay as you earn plan, pay just based off of my income and not have tax penalties associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
And other people have said, you know, I don't care if it was $20,000 a month extra to be married, I would be married anyway, legally. And then I actually, Caitlin, had one case where I told people it was going to cost them like $10,000 a year to be married, and they went and got a strategic divorce.
Yeah, I have some classmates who started this program married, and after fully realizing the implications, have debated, like, maybe I should have gotten divorced or not gotten married at all. And I certainly agree. It's a highly personal choice, and it's something we made just, like you said, in a sense of what was right for us. But I know financially, sure, there's probably some benefits we gave up when we decided to combine incomes.
Not a massive amount. I'll say this. So you are expecting approximately $60,000 of income, like when you graduate, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's approximately equal to what your spouse has right now, right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that right? Like your approximate incomes are about the same?
Yeah, especially those first couple years after graduating.
Right. So as long as those incomes stay roughly the same, then you could look into filing taxes separately instead of jointly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the first time you ever took out student loans ever was in 2010 when you started undergrad?
2005.
Oh, oops, 2005. I take that back. So that's going to make things a little bit more complicated, because 2005 means you don't have access to that pay-as-you-earn program if you took out student loans in 2005, right?
Yeah, I have two undergraduate loans remaining, probably about $3,000, and sort of on a personal mission, my plan is to pay those off in the next 6 months or so, just so that I can have wiped my slate clean of undergrad loans.
Sure. So there's two paths that you can take. You know, you can pay this back, in which case I generally tell people be as aggressive as possible paying back all of their debt, or you want to be strategic and pay as little as possible and figure out, you know, how to pay as little as possible.
Okay.
So the issue that I see with folks is if your debt to income ratio is below 1.5 to 1, then refinancing can make a lot of sense. So in other words, if you have $250,000 of debt, just to try to make that math easier on me, you know, it's mm-hmm. about $166,000 of income that you'd want to make as a household to pay back that loan.
Okay.
So if you're below that, then the forgiveness path is going to look better. Now, when thinking about this with your wife, when you have to file taxes separately, but you don't have access to the pay-as-you-earn plan, then your only option to file in such a way that you exclude your spouse from having to make payments on your loan, or basically have higher payments on your loan because of your spouse, would be the IBR program. Mm-hmm. And filing separately and doing the IBR program. So that monthly payment on the IBR program for you, I think, would be around $500 a month.
Okay.
And then for the revised pay-as-you-earn program, that'd be about $760 a month.
Okay.
So about $250 a month difference. Now, you would save some money in taxes by filing jointly instead of separately. So that's one thing that I'd ask is also, you know, how complicated do you want your life to be?
True. Very true.
Right. What are your thoughts? Like, would you rather cost yourself a little bit more money but have a simpler life, or jump through all the hoops?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the question I have is part of me psychologically knows that the aggressive pay down of the loans is going to cost me more money, but I can't help but think my stress levels for the 20 to 25 years that income-based repayment would take me would be much reduced if I hustled for it. And, you know, I don't know where the income will lie out, you know, if my spouse continues to work 5 years or 10 years or 15 or 20 years after I graduate, and how combined that might change our picture. But I certainly file my own taxes every year, and I've gotten pretty good about getting creative. And so I'm not opposed to looking into sort of filing separately for the sake of reducing a monthly minimum of payment.
Right. And you know, you're on the financial independence kind of bandwagon, right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
You're interested in this movement. You like the idea of not having to work unless you wanted to. And it sounds like you found a career where you feel like you can do it regardless of the money because you just enjoy it, right? Mm-hmm. Which is really amazing. I mean, am I putting words in your mouth, or is that accurate?
No, it's one of those, if I had discovered maybe financial independence before I ever thought of applying to this program, there's a strong chance maybe it ended up in a different area. But unfortunately, I found it in my second or third year, as we found out that we were having to move out of our rental property and started looking into buying a house. And so I really got the fear put into me about making such a big purchase in the middle of medical school. And because of that, found Mr. Money Mustache, and like a lot of people, was converted and changed a lot of our financial habits. So I'm in this sort of in between where I want to really free up my future so that I have some flexibility about what my work life looks like, but also recognize that this is a program that has a significant debt load and not always the income to match it.
So tell me what your bare bones monthly expenses would be to be happy?
Paying utilities. I'd say we're relatively frugal people. We do have pets.
I think I hear him in the background.
Yes. Trying to keep the dog busy. But I would say conservatively about $2,500 to $3,000 a month would cover all of our basic life needs and maybe leave us a little bit of cushion. So
let's do $3,000 a month. And let's say that's $36,000 a year.
Okay.
So multiply that by 25, right? Your famous 4% rule.
Exactly.
And for those that don't know, the listeners that don't know, the 4% rule is this rule that is popularized by the financial independence movement, aka the FIRE movement. FIRE stands for financial independence, retire early. And the FIRE movement basically says that if you have 25 times your expenses and investments, then you are financially independent. You don't have to work unless you want to, right? So your number based off of that conversation would be $900,000. Now, you have a lot of student loan debt.
True.
Or you will. So when you finish graduation, do you bum rush the student loan debt and try to get rid of that as fast as you can and then work on financial independence? Or is there a different way? I'm wondering, have you ever put a lot of thought into that? What are your thoughts on trying to pursue financial independence, even though you made a decision that, oh man, if I could take that back, like maybe at least I would have done a couple things differently.
Yeah, I sort of assumed when I started this program, even not being aware of the FIRE movement, that I would just pay him off as quick as I humanly could. And then once I realized the amount of debt I was going to walk out with, realized that maybe that wasn't even going to be possible. And so switched course to considering income-based repayment or repay or public service loan forgiveness as the best options. And then I think, you know, in learning about financial independence and the ability to sort of psychologically control my motivation to work and how many days a week, and just having some ability to have flexibility around that as I get older, that made me reconsider if I wanted to have 20 to 25 years of student loans accumulating debt just hanging over my head, and if that would maybe have some opportunity costs as far as investing and real estate and the ability to generate some passive income if I had this black cloud that followed me around everywhere I went. And so I would say now that my tendency is to look towards paying it off as aggressively as possible, because I know that that doesn't make sense financially. I guess I alternate depending on what the logic of the day is. Is it the psychological win or is it the financial win?
Sure. Here's another question for you. You told me a little bit about a 529 plan that you're using to pay tuition. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. And so this wasn't something that I had access to in undergrad, just with my family's background. And so I always thought, oh, that's great. And I'll think about it for my kids. And then I looked into it one day and realized that I could create a 529 plan, but also make myself the beneficiary of it. And what I realized is that my spouse, you know, makes sort of an average middle class income, but she is paying state income tax on it. And in the state that I live, there's a contribution, I believe, of $4,500 that can be made, where that would be not taxed by the state. And, you know, that maybe works out to being a negligible amount of money. But I thought, you know, maybe this is a good way to get me to reduce the amount of loans that I'm taking, set up some savings goals, and start paying chunks of my tuition every term. And so what we agreed on is routing a small piece of her paycheck every 2 weeks into this account. That means she doesn't pay state income tax on it once we file our taxes at the end of the year. It means that I have a couple $100 accumulating small amounts of interest every month. And then when a new school term starts, I go and I withdraw that money and pay my tuition. And $500 to $800 of tuition paid means that same amount of money I don't have to take out in student loans, and working on overall reducing the amount of loans I take out going forward.
So I have a highly irresponsible suggestion for you, Caitlin.
What's that?
So I actually think that that's a mistake to pay extra money on your tuition with the 529.
Okay.
Here's why. Ran some numbers. If you open your own naturopathic office, right, you're going to have a lot of write-offs. You're going to write off probably rent, maybe some other expenses with the property, various insurance stuff that you have to keep just in case somebody slips and falls in front of the office, right?
Mm-hmm.
Probably some form of other kinds of insurance, perhaps, maybe like, I don't know if there's malpractice in naturopathic or not.
Yes.
But you have to pay that. You know, just thinking about what your income would look like. Also, you could set up a 401k plan if you're the boss. If you're not, if you're an independent contractor, then you could set up like a solo 401k or an SEP IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that you can contribute even more than the typical limit to a 401k for an employee, which is $19,000 in 2019. A $19,000 limit for your 401k, your choice is paying down your student loans, which even if you were really aggressive, you'd have to pay like $5,000 a month to pay it off in 5 years, right? Which is like, it would be probably more than your entire take-home pay.
Mm-hmm.
So realistically, it would probably take you 7 years to pay off your student loans, I think. Do you believe that? Or do you think that that's a little too aggressive, not aggressive enough?
I think that's about right. I expect that, you know, if I went the aggressive route, it could be as much as even 10 years, depending on how my financial picture sorts out.
Yeah, so it could take a little while, especially, you know, maybe you have some kids, you know, those, I've heard a rumor that they're not cheap. You know, you have kids and then all of a sudden, you know, okay, maybe 7 years turns into 10. At that point, fast forward 10 years in your life and are you where you want to be financially?
Mm-hmm.
So with going like a revised pay-as-you-earn route and just filing jointly for taxes, then one benefit to that is you would benefit from your wife contributing to a retirement plan.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can both contribute the max to a 401k, like a traditional 401k, that'd be $19,000 each. So that's like $38,000 a year. That would, you know, in 10 years, give you $380,000 of principal contributed, and then probably more than that, hopefully, for investment returns.
Mm-hmm.
That would get you at least part of the way to that $900,000, right? Now, here's something else to consider about that 529. The math that I was running just to see what the costs would look like shows that going for like a loan forgiveness strategy where you put the money aside for the tax bomb has got a projected cost that's like about $100,000 cheaper than paying it back straight up.
Okay.
That's in, you know, present value terms. So that's like in today's dollars, but that's a lot. $100,000 mm-hmm. is a lot of money.
Yeah, especially if it's somewhere else gaining interest.
Right. In other words, you know, the cost in today's dollars that I came up with is about $140,000 if you discount all the cash flows and everything like that. And you owe $246,000, or you will when you graduate, is our guess. So that means that the value, the present value of your payback, since you'd be eligible to go for a loan forgiveness 25-year kind of strategy with a tax bomb, that's maybe about 60-ish percent of what you actually owe.
Well,
by paying a dollar, what you're really doing is getting back 60 cents.
True. Yeah.
Right. We have a very perverse loan system in the US that kind of encourages people to take out as much debt as possible. If you're going to finish your naturopathic degree, then the 529 money would probably be better held back. And the reason I say that is because you could take out the loans and cover everything with loans. And in fact, you know, the smart thing to do is, as terrible as it sounds, is actually to maximize your loans, take out as much as you can. And the 529, you can have yourself be the beneficiary when, and if you have children, you can change that beneficiary from yourself to your child.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it depends on the state rules and everything, but you probably could move that over to the name of the child. And then say you have put away $15,000 in a 529 by the time you have your first baby, then mm-hmm. that $15,000 would probably grow into, over like 18 years, enough money to pay a couple years of undergrad at like Oregon or Oregon State.
Mm-hmm. True.
So then you could protect your children from having to take out student loans, at least for undergrad. And then for graduate school, you could say, okay, you're on your own after that. But you know, you would also have been through this financial independence journey where you'd have so much more knowledge on how to achieve financial security that you could be sharing with your children. Just an idea there, that money that you're contributing to get that state tax break, you might be able to still do that and it might still make sense, but it might make more sense to kind of hold that money back in the 529 to use for future generations rather mm-hmm. than to use it for yourself.
Yeah, I never really thought about it as maybe an investment that 10 or 15 years down the road pays even bigger dividends to an expense that I might have to pay for my own kids.
Right, because it grows tax deferred and a lot of people don't know that you can make yourself the beneficiary, but then change the beneficiary to someone who's not even born yet. And when they're born, you can change it to them.
I also think a limitation I have now is that with the money I do contribute, it goes into just the FDIC insured sort of money market account, because I obviously don't want that money to lose value while it's sitting there between terms. And so the sort of interest rate is highly conservative. Whereas if I think about it as more of a 10 to 15 years down the road, I could change the allocation so that it has potentially a bigger opportunity to get interest at a higher rate.
Right. So your retirement contributions might be like $1,500 a month each, approximately, right? So that's $3,000 you're putting aside a month for retirement combined between you and your wife. And then because you get a state income tax break and a federal tax break, and you get lower student loan payments, so you're probably looking at $2,000 a month in terms of take-home pay, as far as like what the impact of putting money for retirement would be. So you could do, you know, the 529 contribution too, if you wanted to. And then on top of that, you know, you have to prepare for the tax consequence of loan forgiveness. Mm-hmm. So for your individual situation, I think that putting aside as little as a couple hundred dollars a month would probably give you enough cushion to feel comfortable with being able to cover that tax bomb, so to speak, which is not too bad. Now, if you're trying to hit a $900,000 figure of assets, you know, your retirement contributions probably get you there in 10 years with about half of it. If you were contributing a couple thousand dollars to a brokerage account, you know, like VTSAX or something like that, and, you know, I have to throw it out there, I'm not a financial advisor, can't provide investment advice, but for entertainment purposes, VTSAX is a total stock market index fund that has like super low expense ratio. And over a long period of time, the expected return from stocks is higher than bonds and certainly higher than a savings account. You know, you put that money aside over time and you could put $2,000 a month in there and maybe you have more of a diversified portfolio than that. But over time, you could get up close to that $900,000 figure, certainly as a couple in 10 years time. And it actually wouldn't be the craziest thing ever, right?
So do you think in the meantime, I'm still in school, I have a little bit of money coming in every month through various side hustle type income sources, that money should be allocated into a retirement account for myself, as opposed to trying to pay my tuition down?
Yeah. I mean, I personally would say that, but on a more general note, for listeners who have credit cards, car loans, right? Like personal loans, those kind of things. Student debt, if it's with the federal government, is one of the very best kinds of debt that exists. Now, that said, that's kind of like saying that stage one cancer is the very best kind of cancer. Like, it's still not great, right? I mean, like, you know, it's still like cancer. Like, you still hear that and you're like, oh my gosh, you know, even though it's super treatable, super easy to deal with if you have the right plan in place, right? The right treatment plan. So it's kind of like that with student loan debt. If you have more federal student loan debt, I almost don't care how big it is because of the fact that you have all these different programs you can use and different things you can do to mess around with it. The thing that really concerns me a lot is when somebody buys into the 0% car loan myth, you know, that's somehow a good deal, right? They buy mm-hmm. into the idea that leasing a car is a good idea. They have a house that's 3.5 times their income. They have credit card debt. They don't have an emergency fund. All of that stuff for you, Caitlin, is luckily cleaned up, right?
Yeah, it's been a dedicated effort the last 2 to 3 years to get rid of all of my consumer debt, build a good emergency fund. And then that's where I'm at now, is sort of the position to realize where should I now allocate this money.
So I would say that you want to make sure you have a $10,000 emergency fund first before doing anything. And I think you might already have that, right?
Yeah, I believe we have about $8,000. So we're almost there. Yeah, be there in a matter of months if we made that a dedicated effort.
So I would say that's your first priority, is get to the 10,000. That's kind of like a psychological victory to have that much security and short-term cash savings. And once you're past that point, you could really go either way with it. You could contribute to brokerage accounts or retirement accounts. Either one is fine. You know, right now you're not getting the student loan cut on your required payments because you're not making payments because you're still in school. Mm-hmm. So, and you're in a very low income tax bracket as well. The benefit of contributing to retirement accounts right now is probably very limited. You know, you could do Roth accounts probably right now, even though once you start working, you probably would want to switch to the pre-tax accounts.
Okay.
So I think that it's okay to just get money piled away into assets right now. Once you get to 50,000, that's like your first big victory. Then you get to 100,000 and you're like, wow, I never thought we would get here. And then gradually you just work on building up assets. And another crazy thing, the best thing that could happen to you is that the stock market would crash in the next few years, because then you could be putting away tons more money. Sounds great, right?
Yeah, it's not a crash. It's just a discount sale on everything.
Exactly. So a lot of people don't realize that. So they sell everything after it's fallen 50% and they wait to get back in until their brother-in-law is bragging to them about, you know, how they doubled their money with Tesla, and then, you know, everybody pops back in, and then it's just like a vicious cycle. But to somebody who's an educated investor, that you know to hold on and buy more in market crashes. So you do that, and then in 10 years, I see no reason why you couldn't have 900,000 in assets with a 30 to 40% savings rate. You know, if you could approach 50% of your take-home pay, like that'd be ideal. But if you had a very, very high savings rate and dedicated yourself to growing your investment pile of retirement plus brokerage assets and having no consumer debt of any other kinds. And another thing too is avoiding a expensive real estate mistake in Oregon. So I wonder, what would you say the rents are like and the mortgages is like out there and where you live?
It's high. It's taken a huge swing in the increasing costs in the last 10 years. I think when I first moved here, I was paying $700 a month for a two-bedroom, one bath, and that was in 2010. And now it's pretty typical to spend $1,200 or $1,500 for the same type of place. The mortgages arguably maybe are a little cheaper. Right now we're paying about $1,400, but we also moved to one of the suburbs of Portland that isn't as desirable as some of the hipper areas of town. But definitely the $1,500 mark, I'd say, is typical for most people looking at like a two-bedroom, one-bath type setup.
So you own your own house?
My wife bought it, and I wasn't involved in any sort of portion of the sale, obviously, with my student loan debt, no income. You know, the mortgage broker basically said it's better to just have you not on the paperwork at all. So I guess it's the best gift I could have asked for.
Yeah. If there's any ability to house hack, that would be huge. I don't think there sounds like there is, but if you can get creative at all, I mean, and it might even just be, you know, if you decide to have kids, then just not upgrading to the bigger house like everybody tends to do. I was talking to Rob, one of my consultant partners, and he told me that the average spending for a family that has children increases by 40%. I was like, wow, that's just crazy. And he said it's mostly because people go out and buy a bigger house. They buy the bigger van that they view as safer, that's newer, all these things. But so that's good that you own the house already. You don't have that giant mortgage that you're going to take on in a forward-looking basis.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know if you have a lot of equity in it, or is it heavily mortgaged right now?
We do. We do have equity in it already. I mean, Portland being a booming market in general, I think we had equity just from when we made the offer to when the sale closed. We picked up probably 10 grand easily. We also bought in a real sweet spot in the market with my school schedule. I was really tied up during the fall when we were looking, and we ended up looking the week between Christmas and New Year's. We had a realtor who was a real champ and decided to come out with us and look at houses. So we bought in kind of the sleepiest part of the year when, if you're willing to move your family to a different house during that time, you're highly motivated to sell. And we got real lucky with a big family where this house was way too small for them. They were bursting at the seams, wanted out quickly, and we were able to kind of make a move on a house and probably have $30,000 of equity in the last 2 years, and also done quite a bit of our own remodeling and addressing some major issues that they had let slide.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you wanted to get to financial independence sooner, then I would look into some weird ideas for utilizing the fact that you have this nice house, anything from Airbnb-ing to maybe you have, I don't know if you have any land at all, but maybe having some tiny house people hanging out for a little bit. I don't know. Maybe this is too crazy, Caitlin. What do you think?
No, I'm super interested in it. I'm sort of like a lot of people who discover financial independence. I'm the gung-ho spouse and have got a spouse who definitely supports me and has made a lot of changes in their own respect, but doesn't get as nuts about it as I do. And so we do have about a quarter acre lot, which is definitely bigger than most in this area. And we've debated about, is it worthwhile to try and look into like a home equity line of credit and build a little garage apartment type thing? Or, you know, I don't know if my spouse would be on board for renting out to someone else just because of the comfort that comes with walking around your own house and being not having to deal with roommates anymore. But yeah, it is worthwhile to maybe consider some options for the amount of space that we have.
Yeah. And ultimately, it's just how bad do you want to get to that number? You know, how bad do you want work to be optional, right?
True.
A couple more questions for you here. The difference with people who have a bunch of student loans going for financial independence versus people who don't have any student debt is, if you're going to go for student loan debt, like payoff and financial independence at the same time, then having a tax bomb ready to go is kind of what you need to feel secure. So if your number is 900,000, if you have student loan debt and you have a tax bomb that's projected to be like 150,000, let's say, then if in 10 years, if you could hit half of that in the tax bomb account, so 75,000, that 75,000 will probably grow into the 150 over a 10-year time frame. Or, you know, maybe you could be more conservative and say like 100,000 would grow into that 150,000 that you need.
Mm-hmm.
You figure out what that number is, And then you add that on top of the $900,000 that you need to be financially independent.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe your financial independence number, instead of being 900,000, maybe it's 900,000 plus 100 for the tax bomb.
Yeah. And I recognize that maybe having, you know, the financial independence sets us up for a lot of success when we stick to it. And maybe thinking about the fact that I could get the 900,000 into a, whether it's 401k or a brokerage account, maybe that sort of negates the negative feelings I have about this black cloud of accumulating student loan debt that follows me around for 25 years, where that could potentially outweigh the negative factors of going for forgiveness.
Yeah, because if you had 900,000 in assets and 300,000 in student loan debt, would you be stressed?
I think I would feel, I'd sleep a little better at night, knowing that if push came to shove, I had a source to tap into and could know that at least those things balance each other out in the direction of a positive net worth.
You could write a check, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, at the end of the day, like, that would be amazing to be able to literally cut a check and be done with your debt. I think that if you had that amount of assets, life would feel differently. So for you, I think that rather than focus on a traditional pay down my debt kind of mindset, I think the path instead can be, how do we minimize our adjusted gross income? How do we get a max savings rate that we possibly can by living, you know, an alternative lifestyle, right?
Yeah, so I think just getting more creative than I was before I started school.
And another thing too, if you want to kind of benefit a little bit now from having flexible hours, working less, enjoying life more, that's possible too. If you never want to retire completely from your career in the next, say, 10 to 20 years, you are okay working, doing some level of paid work as a naturopath or acupuncturist, whatever you're going to do, then you could work, say, 20 hours a week and your payment's always based on your income, right?
Yeah, and that's what I'm really motivated by. I think the retire early part of the FIRE movement assumes that gung-ho, get over the debt as quickly as possible and have this 4% rule sorted out and then never work again. And I do love my intended profession and the school that I'm going to and feel strongly about it. And so ultimately for me, it would look more like having the ability to set my own work hours and work sporadically, like you said, maybe only 20 hours a week, and the ability to take time off without worrying about the income stream as much.
And a lot of people don't think that they can do part-time work because of their student loan debt. So nothing could be further from the truth. Are there opportunities as a naturopath to work part-time?
Absolutely. I mean, we talked about a lot of the difficulties of being an entrepreneur and maybe owning your own practice or being a sort of self-employed independent contractor. But I think the flip side of that is that you can really have a lot of control over the amount of patients that you see, the days that you work, the times, you know, that you're making yourself available, but also just with advances in technology, things like telemedicine has gotten into the naturopathic realm as well. So it's not unusual to work remotely, work from home, or even get into sort of more passive things like writing or supplement company advising or consulting, different types of jobs where you're working for maybe a shorter period of time each week.
Cool. Now, let me ask one more question, Caitlin. What would you do differently if you could go back in time before accepting your offer of acceptance to the naturopathic program? And then what would you tell somebody who is thinking about doing this path? Like, what things should they consider? And are there other alternatives to being a naturopathic doctor?
Yeah, I think before starting, I think anyone should take a good hard look at the numbers. I think we talked a bit about the income potential versus the amount of debt that you accumulate. I thought that I had a good handle of that when I started, and I really was kind of naive about it. So whether that's talking with current doctors, understanding what their actual take-home income looks like once they factor in all their expenses, and then also what their student loan picture looks like, because it is rapidly increasing with each sort of graduating class. So using practicing doctors as a good resource for how your income might look in your area or the subspecialty of medicine you see yourself practicing. And then coming into the program in the best position of financial strength, I think, is what I would recommend is, you know, like you talked about, making sure your credit card debt, you know, high interest car loans, things like that are addressed and paid off with the money that you had from a maybe previous job, as opposed to having to take your financial aid money that's already coming at sometimes a 7% interest rate, and then turning around and paying that towards a 15 to 20 to 25% credit card every month. And so getting yourself in that position of strength so that any expenses you do have are minimal and aren't accumulating interest in their own right.
Awesome. Well, Caitlin, thanks so much for being on the show. If you're a listener out there who wants to give some ideas for future podcast episodes, make comments, insults, jokes, send them to podcast@studentloanplanner.com. If you want to get a time to book for yourself for getting a student loan plan, go to studentloanplanner.com/help to read more about how we could potentially help you. So Caitlin, thanks so much again for being on the show and teaching us more about the naturopathic world.
Thanks, Travis.
Thank you for listening to today's show. If you know that you need a custom student loan plan, you can schedule one today at studentloanplanner.com/book. You can find the show notes for today's episode at studentloanplanner.com/the number of the episode. And finally, if you like the podcast, leave us a review or share it with someone who owes more than you. Have a great week.